China's President Xi Jinping has been having a busy year. In the first 5 months of 2026, more than 20 world leaders have travelled to Beijing to meet with the man who stands at the apex of power in the Chinese state. The roll call includes the British and Canadian Prime Ministers, the German Chancellor, and more recently, the President of the United States. Such meetings have sparked significant debate concerning China's role in the world economy. At a time when globalization is under strain, Xi Jinping has attempted to present his country as a reliable defender of free trade and a rules-based international system. And yet, there is a gap between rhetoric and reality. While preaching the gospel of free trade, Xi's China has also sought to engineer the world economy in its own favor, establishing a Chinese chokehold over critical resources and securing dominance of several export markets. In doing so, it has built a formidable mercantilist system that protects Beijing's interests while distorting global trade. So how does this system work within China and beyond? What is the geopolitical vision that underpins it? And how should Western leaders navigate the challenges posed by Beijing's ambitions? This is Jack Dickens, literary editor at Engelsberg Ideas. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by George Magnus, research associate at the China Centre of the University of Oxford, and a former chief economist at the investment bank UBS. George, a hearty welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Jack.
So as an experienced economist and China watcher, what do you make of Donald Trump's recent visit to Beijing last month?
I think there were pretty low expectations for this summit meeting, and for good reason, to be fair. I mean, relationships between the United States and China are probably worse than Donald Trump thinks his relationship is with Xi Jinping. And the two countries obviously have, you know, they have locked horns in a huge kind of strategic competition that extends from economics to finance to trade and, you know, military influence in different parts of the world and so on. And of course, they are, you know, trying to set different standards for technology and the way business is conducted, and generally their overall stance in terms of how governance should take place in the world. So nobody really expected there was going to be any kind of big breakthrough or love-in in Beijing. But what they did do is they both agreed to take time out, essentially. I mean, there were some gratuitous sort of agreements on, you know, the two B's, beans, soybeans, and Boeings. I mean, not huge trade deals that Donald Trump could take back to the United States, but they were something, I suppose. But the main thing really was a sort of a truce, really, that they agreed to kind of stay out of each other's way, not to escalate anything at the moment. And they both have domestic reasons why they would appreciate, you know, the opportunity not to have to worry about Sino-US relations. So I think that was the sort of the low value expectation of the summit. And that's basically what happened.
And in the context of great power competition and great power rivalry, might that be seen as a success of a kind? The fact that you have two leaders coming to meet one another and agreeing just to take a pause and just to take stock of how things are going?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably churlish to say that that's not worthwhile. I mean, we know that relationships have been much rockier than they are at the moment. And, you know, nobody in their right mind would want that relationship to become more sort of conflict prone. So the fact that they are having a dialogue that actually behind the leadership level, there are institutions of government on both sides that are discussing things all the time, and they may not always agree about everything, but dialogue is better than not having dialogue, and détente of some description is obviously not a bad thing in and of itself. So that's the good news, I guess. I mean, I'm not optimistic that they're really going to resolve huge amounts of tensions and conflicts that exist between them in the commercial and business and financial spheres. But yeah, I mean, we had a form of détente with the Soviet Union for many, many years. And I suppose that's kind of what we should hope for with regards to China as well.
So much has been made out of what President Trump wanted from the meeting, in particular wanting to put pressure on Xi Jinping to also, in turn, put pressure on Iran to end its blockade of the Strait of Hormuz and bring about some kind of diplomatic settlement to the crisis in the Middle East. But do we have a sense also of what Xi Jinping wanted from this meeting and whether he will have considered any of it to have been achieved?
The optics certainly suggested that he was not just the host, but actually a sort of a commanding host. Not that Trump, you know, kind of looked necessarily like a supplicant, but I think probably the Chinese are pretty comfortable at this point in time. I mean, definitely comfortable in the sense that they have stood up to Trump's tariffs in ways which no other country really has done. Of course, they have the economic heft to be able to do that. They have, in the last couple of years, certainly passed a lot of legislation which allows them a legal basis to resist American sanctions if need be, I mean, inside China, and to take retaliatory action against companies that do act against Chinese entities. They also have laws that allow them to intervene in an extraterritorial sense. I mean, the Americans have this too, but in an extraterritorial sense, so that the laws that apply in China may also be applied to other countries and states where, and if the Chinese government were to decide that were necessary. So with that, and with the control over this choke point of what we call rare earth elements, so these are the probably 12 or 15 magnets and minerals, which the valuation of these things in global trade is very small. But if you think about the industries that withholding these rare earth elements could bring to a halt, which is like aerospace, defense, automobile production, the whole kind of semiconductor industry and so on. I mean, the leverage which that power that China has over the United States and Europe and the rest of the world is not to be understated. I mean, obviously, we're trying now as fast as we possibly can, but it may take some time to lessen our dependence on China in this regard, but it can't really happen overnight. So for all of these reasons, China is probably feeling quite smug. They like the idea that obviously the United States is distracted by this war in the Middle East and had to move resources and ships and soldiers and material out of the Asia-Pacific region to the Gulf. Obviously, that's a distraction so far as China is concerned. So for all these reasons, I think probably what Xi Jinping wanted out of Trump was, you know, he just wants him to behave himself. And, obviously the Chinese will have been certainly well aware about the legal difficulties which Trump has with the Supreme Court about the legitimacy of his tariffs in the first place. So, yeah, I think they just want the Americans just to back off. You know, they don't want to be hounded by what they feel is this sort of insolent terrier.
And might there be some concerns for China, though, if the war in the Middle East continues, if global oil trade and the global energy trade is continually disrupted? I remember you wrote for Engelsberg Ideas pointing out that China isn't necessarily a beneficiary of what's going on in the Middle East right now. Could you just expand on that?
Yes. Well, of course, the Chinese economy is, I should have said actually in response to the last question as well, what the Chinese did want from Donald Trump, which we're not sure that he got, was a change in the American language, diplomatic language regarding Taiwan. Hitherto, the Americans have had this kind of ambivalence about what they feel. You know, they can't say they support independence of Taiwan, but they're not prepared to recognize that it's an integral part of the mainland, which is what ideally the Chinese government would like the American government to move towards. So we're awaiting kind of news, for example, about an arms deal. So that's something which at least nominally Xi Jinping hasn't yet as yet got from the United States. But China is, in response to your follow-up question, the Chinese economy is highly geared towards the economies of the United States and Europe. So notwithstanding all of the kind of publicity that exists about, you know, China and the global South and China-India trade and China in Africa and all of this kind of stuff, I mean, all of these things are true, through the BRICS plus group of countries and through the Belt and Road universe of countries, but the vast majority of Chinese trade and commerce is and investment is conducted with entities in the United States and Canada and Europe. And so if the war in or the disturbances, I mean, it's obviously not an overt conflict going on, at least at this point in time, but if the disturbances and the trouble in the Middle East were to flare up again, and we were to see an extended or protracted period of very high energy prices and demand contraction or destruction in the US and Europe, that's not something which would benefit China at all. So indirectly, China does have concerns about the longevity and the scale of conflict in the Middle East, even though politically, obviously, they feel, as I said before, you know, a little bit smug that the Americans have been drawn into something which is causing a lot of trouble.
Which all begs the question for me as to why Xi Jinping doesn't appear to be more eager to do something to put pressure on Iran to end what is going on in the Strait of Hormuz at the moment. Do you have a view on that?
Actually, I'm not absolutely sure that I am confident that China has that capacity. So for all sorts of reasons, I mean, maybe not always good reasons, but I think it's probably still fair to say that the United States is probably the only country in the world that can move its military forces to different parts of the world with some effect. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, that what they've done in Iran has been effective from the point of view of best case outcomes, but the Chinese don't really have that capacity to maneuver or to move their navy or their military forces like that. And they will no doubt be in conversation. I think the Iranian foreign minister was actually in Beijing before Donald Trump went there. They're certainly going to be in conversation with the Iranians and other countries in the Gulf, where they have considerable investments, by the way, particularly in Saudi Arabia and in the United Arab Emirates, much more than in Iran itself. And I'm sure, you know, it would be churlish to say that they probably aren't trying to have conversations which would result in some kind of compromise, which they would be kind of very comfortable with. But I'm just not sure that they have the capacity and the political leverage to be able to deliver that kind of agenda, because they can say to the Iranians, well, we, you know, we really think it'd be a good idea if the Strait of Hormuz could be opened, and very good idea if, you know, you could just try and calm things down a bit in the Gulf and around the Gulf and so on and so forth. But actually, I mean, the Chinese are kind of a little bit conflicted in this way, because actually they do provide communications and telecommunications and I don't know what other kinds of equipment to the Iranians and to other participants in the region. Yeah, I mean, it's a very much more kind of commercial and transactional relationship, I think, than it is a political relationship. So it's questionable, really, about how much influence they actually can bring to bear, to be fair.
Now, there is a geopolitical logic behind the economic policies pursued by Xi Jinping and his government, and it is a mercantilist logic. Could you explain what mercantilism means in the Chinese context?
Yeah, so, I mean, mercantilism really is, I think probably most people have come across it in different forms. Anybody that knows anything about, for example, the big trade theorists of the many centuries ago, like Adam Smith and David Ricardo, I mean, these people were kind of vehemently opposed to mercantilism. The idea behind mercantilism really is that you trade and you accumulate wealth for national prestige and power, not because you necessarily have a comparative advantage, shall we say, in producing X and swapping it with somebody else who has a comparative advantage in producing Y. I mean, that's the basis of free trade and why, you know, the free traders throughout history, including the Brits, have always thought that trade was a win-win solution for mankind, because actually everybody gets richer and better off if they can specialize in things that they're good at doing. Okay, that's slightly idealistic as well, because in practical terms, we've always had some degree of trade that's not free. I mean, tariffs have been part of the the scene, whether it's, you know, Alexander Hamilton in the United States, or whether it was, you know, the British Corn Laws or whatever it happens to be. I mean, we've always had periods of unfree trade and alternating with periods of free trade. But in a contemporary and Chinese sense, the McCasnism really is about a country that actually prides itself on running giant export surpluses and accumulating trillions of dollars of reserves as a source and a revelation, really, of national pride and prestige. And really, that's good for China in a sense, but not good for everybody else. So very often, you know, we read and hear about institutions and politicians talking about China as being an engine of global growth. The fact that China has the fastest growth rate in amongst many, many countries, which at least on official measurement it is, but not necessarily in fact. But let's take even just the official kind of measurement of growth. At 5% or whatever the official growth rate for China is, it sounds like it's really feisty, especially compared with growth rates that we're comfortable with in Europe. But actually, a lot of that growth comes about from the export surplus, which is really about piling up loads and loads of exports, but not really importing that much or not really growing imports a lot. So this imbalance in trade, which is something that is basically the result of economic policy in China, is really part of the whole mercantilist shtick, if you want to put it that way, which results in the, you know, registration of these huge export surpluses against which more and more countries are starting to push back. So in many ways, the International Monetary Fund and global institutions are places where China has, you know, very, very significant presence and interest. And historically, they've been very, very reluctant to criticize or be critical of China. But even the IMF is starting to become a little bit kind of hot under the collar about the failure of China to address this problem, because it's clearly not good for the world. And it's not good for, I would say, Europe in particular at this juncture, because more and more of Chinese exports are kind of mapping the kind of exports that Europeans, the South Koreans, the Japanese, for example, are specialists in. But actually, what the Chinese are not doing is they're not kind of balancing this on the other side by importing, you know, more goods that we can produce. So that's the kind of the nature of the problem behind Chinese mercantilism. It's really something that's being done from a very kind of nationalistic point of view in China, and not something which is really constructive from the point of view of solving global problems.
I wonder, could you give us more of a sense of the nuts and bolts of Chinese mercantilism as well, and the industrial policy that goes into it? What is, you know, for example, the mechanism by which the Chinese state's industrial policy leads to these kinds of distortions of global trade in the world economy?
Right. Well, if you take, for example, the kind of the three of the kind of lead sectors in China's modern manufacturing universe, so to speak, these are electric vehicles, lithium batteries, and solar photovoltaic equipment, solar panels, basically. Each of these three industries are currently experiencing chronic overproduction. There are some very, very successful electric vehicle firms, for example. I mean, a handful of them, literally a handful, and battery companies as well. But in each of these three industries, these industries are dominated by excess production at home and a kind of a raft of loss-making enterprises, which basically should be wound up, but it's politically very difficult to enact. I mean, they do have bankruptcy laws in China, of course, but actually companies don't go bankrupt as often as they probably should, given the uncommercial viability of many of these industries. So the gist of it really is that industrial policy, on which China spends maybe about 5 or 6% of its GDP every year, in the OECD countries, we spend about a half to 1% of GDP in the aggregate. So China does it on a scale which is just something we can't compete with or won't compete with. And what this results in is chronic overproduction, and therefore that production eventually leaks overseas because demand inside the Chinese economy isn't strong enough to absorb it. So when you see, for example, that China has 90% market share in rare earths, 80% market share in solar panels, 50 or 60% market share in automobiles and batteries, and very, very high market shares in lots and lots of other equipments as well. I mean, the problem here really is a sort of a systemic problem where the system, the economic policy infrastructure, and the incentives are all geared towards production and supply, but not to consumer demand. And so one of the problems, big problems systemically in China, is the relative weakness of the household sector. So China's consumption as a share of GDP is quite low. It's about 40%. Even China's peer group like Turkey, Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, Malaysia, Indonesia, for example, a lot of these countries have consumption shares which are much, much higher than they are in China. So it's repressed in China. And I think that's what a lot of politicians now are beginning to become more aware of, which is that there is no trade negotiation that will solve the problem of Chinese export surpluses unless China is prepared to do something about its economic model, which represses consumption, emphasizes production, and where the excess of production, if it's not to cause massive unemployment in China, has to leak abroad to sell to foreign purchasers. And that's really what's going on.
Is it driven fundamentally by a desire to de-risk China's domestic economy and to avoid creating unstable political conditions that might come out of disruptive economic forms to try and fix this system? Is that fundamentally what drives it? Or is that too reductive? Is there a broader geopolitical vision here behind this mercantilist system?
Well, at the back of my mind, I kind of think really that there is something kind of also vaguely, not vaguely, but actually quite specifically historical about this as well. Because actually dynastic China was also very mercantilist. And actually in the famous, visit of Lord MacArthur to the emperor, at the end of the 18th century, the Chinese emperor basically dismissed the British mission, which was sent there to open up Chinese ports to British trade. He basically sent MacArthur packing with a kind of comment that to the effect of, you've actually got nothing that we want. And the sort of contemporary equivalent really is that we in China want to produce everything that we can in the kind of modern manufacturing area, but also in traditional manufacturing, because the 15th five-year plan has given a sort of an additional boost to more traditional forms of manufacturing, as well as quantum mechanics and computing and artificial intelligence and so on. And so they have this kind of idea that actually they have to be responsible for doing most of this themselves because they simply cannot trust foreigners to be an integral part of their own supply chain. Now, to be fair, the Americans and the Europeans think like that too. So we are trying to de-Sinify our supply chains to a degree where we think national security red lines may be breached. We don't, for example, in Britain, we don't want China involved in our energy infrastructure. We don't want China involved in what we do in terms of modern semiconductors and modern equipment in the kind of the chip space. There are certain areas where we feel that the security red lines are sufficiently grave and serious that we actually don't want that to happen. And we think that there are certain types of activity where we want to preserve the ability to educate our own workers and have our own know-how, etc. And I think, there are many countries that feel that way as well. So this is not something which is uniquely Chinese, but nobody has the kind of industrial policy that China has, which basically goes back now to the mid-2000s. So they've been pursuing this for 20 years, and which is an integral part of the economic policy infrastructure in the country. We and the Americans and the Europeans are kind of moving a little bit towards having more industrial policy nowadays, because We think that it's essential to protect native industries that we want to keep or that we think can be part of our makeup in the future. And we need to protect them now against, you know, low-priced or cheap dumped Chinese exports. But this is really not on a scale that is being practiced in China. And so this mercantilist approach that the Chinese have really is designed really to preserve and advance a kind of pre-existing model which they have and which they are politically either unwilling or unable to change because it's just too awkward. Because once you actually start to shift economic power relations between the state on the one hand and the private sector on the other, you're basically starting to take a huge risk with the very raison d'etre of the Communist Party in China, which, you know, it is a bit Marxist. It's not really as Marxist or Leninist as maybe the Soviet Union was in terms of its rigidity. But the raison d'etre of the Communist Party is to rule unchallenged. And for that, the Communist Party has to be in control of everything. And that's basically the philosophy that Xi Jinping is following. So it's very difficult to see how China under Xi Jinping, I mean, he won't be around forever, but he still could be around for quite some time. Very difficult to see how China under Xi Jinping can change its political philosophy or the way that it interacts with the world.
What is the desired endgame from this Chinese mercantilist system? What do Xi Jinping and his allies in the Chinese system want to achieve by pursuing these strategies?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they've been very coy about that at all. And if one reads, you know, Xi Jinping's speeches and the documents which are periodically published, their goal is basically, I mean, to dominate what Xi Jinping calls the fourth industrial revolution. So their emphasis and priority really is to be self-reliant, or more self-reliant, I would say, by 2035, and to be at least a sort of an OECD type economy by the middle of the century, by 2049, which is the centenary of the founding of the People's Republic. And dominating the fourth industrial revolution is really about displacing the United States and Western system, not necessarily crushing it, but China wants to dominate it. It wants to dominate not just in terms of production of goods, but in terms of standards, protocols, governance, the things that make the world happen and work, but which China would like to change to suit its own interests, I suppose, just as the Pax Americana was built after World War II to suit America's interests. So not to be kind of coy about it, but the Chinese don't really want anything that we haven't already had in the past. The trouble is that it's existential for both of us.
One of the interesting things about the modern Chinese economy is that for all of its lackluster and deadwood parts, there are also these islands of extraordinary dynamism and technological vitality, such as DeepSeek AI. That's something that comes to mind, which was a big story from last year, of course. What explains this peculiar dichotomous character? Why are there these islands of real technological efficiency alongside some other dysfunctional parts of the Chinese economy?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I need to just kind of take DeepSeek out of the equation straight away, because actually DeepSeek was, you know, which is China's sort of AI miracle company, is not the outcome of Chinese industrial policy. In fact, I mean, it's the brainchild of a hedge fund entrepreneur who basically built the capacity, called the company DeepSeek. But this is a private sector enterprise, really, from start to finish, I would say. Probably benefits from lots of things that happen in Chinese corporate space, also procurement and just the way in which the market is kind of geared to, obviously, lots of American companies, you know, tech companies do not have full freedom of maneuver and ability to function in China. So it's not a level playing field necessarily in that regard, but not to take anything away from what DeepSeek accomplished. And there are exceptional cases like that where private firms, I mean, genuinely private firms, you know, achieve great results. BYD, for example, Build Your Dreams, which is the lead electric vehicle company, is a private company. I mean, it did benefit from copious funding of and subsidies and below market borrowing conditions for several years, but not more recently. So there are exceptional success stories in China. Alibaba is another one. Tencent is another. Huawei is another. So there are these companies. I mean, they basically have their roots in the period when Chinese entrepreneurs and the Chinese entrepreneurialism, if I can use that word, were given much more of a free rein than they are given today. So these things exist, no question about it, as the product and the fruits of the labors and efforts of Chinese entrepreneurs and private firms. But the more general issue really is that what the Chinese call strategic emerging industries. So these include the kind of the big three of solar panels, batteries, electric vehicles, but also robotics, semiconductor manufacturing, biomedicine, pharmaceuticals. I mean, a lot of the things that actually enter into this space, they together amount to about 10 to 12% of China's economy, which is not inconsiderable, but it's not the bulk of the economy. But these sectors of the economy are very modern. They are very dynamic. They do get huge amounts of government largesse poured through them. But they are very, very different from retailing, distribution, transportation, delivery, you know, the gig economy, which is where most Chinese workers work now, is in the gig economy. So this dichotomy between a kind of very modern, advanced, modern sector that has brands, is the envy of the world, you know, et cetera, sells very, very cheap products. This is really in stark contrast to much of the rest of the economy, which doesn't look anything like this at all, and where productivity has stalled, where there is huge indebtedness, where there's a property market slump going on now in its sixth year, and it doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon. So, you know, in a way, we could look at the Thames Valley, for example, and the home counties and say, well, we have that same discrepancy, you know, because very few, if any, parts of the rest of the United Kingdom look like that. Similarly, if you looked at Silicon Valley and San Francisco and the Bay Area there, you know, you could say that, you know, this bears no relation to, you know, Kentucky or South Dakota or whatever it happens to be. But by and large, really, the extremes of inequality and distinction, I would say, between the modern sector and the rest of the economy are particularly marked in China and reminiscent, although not necessarily identical, of the way that Japan looked at the end of the 1980s with household names like Mitsubishi, Hitachi, Sony, a raft of names that were basically household brands, really. And these companies, you know, were believed to be the kind of the future. Japan had the biggest banks in the world. China now has the biggest banks in the world, et cetera, et cetera. So the problem is that when you have this kind of imbalance in the economy between policies that basically nurture this just kind of huge success in a very kind of relatively small part of the economy, but at the expense of what goes on in 80% or 85% of the rest of the economy, that's not really a tenable situation. Somehow there has to be, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow or next year, but there will be some kind of closure there, because that kind of discrepancy is just not sustainable.
Yes, I think as the American economist Herbert Stein once said, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop.
He did indeed.
On that note, do you think that Japan offers a kind of forewarning for what might happen in China if at some point the system sort of buckles under its own contradictions?
It does in a way, yes. I mean, it's not identical, as I said, because, you know, in Japan, for example, most companies really had terribly bad and overstretched balance sheets. They'd, you know, borrowed too much money. They were very vulnerable to what would eventually happen to land prices and to stock prices and so on. a lot of Chinese private companies, I mean, nominally private companies and kind of private companies, because actually ownership structures are quite opaque in China. I mean, they're not really as badly affected. On the other hand, you know, there are things that are going on in China that didn't happen in Japan. So the government sector, but not the central government in Beijing, but the local government and provincial government sector, which is much more important in China than, let's say, British local authorities are in our own country. In China, the local governments basically have the mandate and responsibility for delivering public goods and services and welfare, which obviously in Britain, you know, the central government has most of the responsibility to do that. But in China, it's local governments and many, many of the 32 provincial governments, and then beneath that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of local government authorities are highly indebted, have to borrow money simply to pay interest on their loans and on their debt. The government is trying to get them to fiscally be more prudent and cut back, but it's very difficult to do that because essentially, I mean, the central government would have to underwrite, you know, whatever financial problems local governments get into. It doesn't want to, but it would ultimately stands responsible. So China has a lot of debt capacity, which is very difficult to actually increase now. Stagnant labor market, very high unemployment, particularly of young people, not uniquely Chinese, but it's a big problem in a country where you don't have the kind of democratic forms of government that we associate with. And, you know, lots of other issues, which I think are find it very, very difficult to address without meaningful political reform. So many Chinese economists, not necessarily working in the government, but certainly working in think tanks and universities across the country, very bravely, you know, on social media, you know, write learned papers about how, you know, we're going down the wrong path. We need to be more entrepreneurial. We need to give more freedom of movement and freedom of opportunity to young people and to private companies. I mean, it's brave stuff because the government obviously doesn't agree with it. But yeah, it's the issue really as to whether, I mean, it's not like there aren't theoretically sound alternative policies for Chinese government to take. It's just that politically, they seem to be very unwilling to do that.
They're almost stuck in this path dependency that they can't break free from.
Indeed. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Do we have a sense of how China's leaders try to diagnose the weaknesses of their system themselves? What kinds of remedies have people like Xi Jinping proposed for some of these challenges that you've highlighted?
That's two slightly different questions. I mean, I'm just reminded now, as you asked me the question, that at the National People's Congress, which takes, this is basically China's kind of parliament that meets once a year in March, and it's basically a rubber stamping parliament, but it does meet once a year, and there is discussion that takes place. And at this year's National People's Congress in Beijing in March, it was kind of special in a way because it wasn't just the usual business that was attended to, but obviously the presentation of the new five-year plan, which runs from 2026 to 2030. And usually at this event, there are loads and loads of very, very wordy reports that get published, including by the Prime Minister or the Premier, whose name is Li Qiang, and also by the Finance Minister. So he presents this sort of budget report. And also there's a report that is published by an institution called the National Development Reform Commission, which used to be called, once upon a time, the State Planning Bureau. So this is really under Maoist times where China took its planning much more in a much more kind of Soviet kind of way. That time has moved on since then, and it dropped its name, rechristened itself. It's obviously not quite as kind of austere as and quantitative as it used to be. But this year, the NDRC, the National Development Reform Commission, was incredibly critical and bothered, really, I would say. There were, it's not pages and pages, it's a very kind of short section, but there's a section in this report where it is quite openly admitting to a series of economic shortcomings and problems, which clearly we all know about, but the Chinese authorities kind of very rarely fess up to, so to speak, in this way. And so these were about, you know, we don't consume enough, we produce too much, We've got to reduce debt. We've got to become more conservative with a small c. You know, they didn't use that word, but that's kind of what they mean in terms of economic policy. I mean, I don't think they can go so far as to say that they recommended a scaling back of industrial policy, although that's kind of implicitly, it's kind of what they might be saying. But it was a recognition, I thought, that some of the policymakers are clearly very au fait and cognizant of the fact that they've got big issues that have to be addressed. Now, in a sense, I'm kind of not surprised to hear that, because when I was visiting China more regularly, I often met policymakers who were quite candid about, yeah, we think we've got a problem here. We're not quite sure what the best way of going about it is. And I think that's probably become more accentuated now. I think it's not like they don't know what the issues are. It's just that I think politically they're in a very difficult and awkward place where they can't really change, and they certainly can't go against the boss. So that's why I said when you asked me the question, there's two questions, that what Xi Jinping thinks about this obviously is the only thing that really matters. It doesn't really matter what other people think. And I think that he's a bit like Margaret Thatcher. He's not for turning. Which is not to say that he's never turned, because obviously at the end of COVID in 2022, I think everybody remembers now the kind of zero COVID policy that was kind of dropped almost overnight. I'm pretty sure it wasn't overnight, but certainly nobody expected it to be dropped as rapidly and abruptly as it was. But it did show that there was a kind of a level of concern where the Communist Party would actually kind of become incredibly pragmatic and say, we have to change this. So I don't know whether Xi Jinping has reached that point yet. I don't think he has. I think he's not a reformer by nature. He doesn't really know that much about economics as far as experts on the kind of Politburo advise. And I think he's a genuine, full-blooded believer that what China is doing with industrial policy is the right way forward. And it's the only way, according to him, that the people of China and the citizens can gain from what the Communist Party calls common prosperity. You know, we might think common prosperity is basically a tax cut for everybody. That's not the way that the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, thinks about it. He thinks that it comes about through the trickle-down effects of eventually having world-dominating industries that make a lot of money. But that's not really the kind of Chinese model. So I think there's an ambivalent answer to your question. One is that, yes, there are policymakers who are only too aware of the nature of many of China's problems, but the boss doesn't really want to hear them.
I think ambivalence is an appropriate word in many ways, because if we take it back to what we were discussing earlier in our conversation about Trump's visits to Beijing and the fact that Xi Jinping will feel in quite a confident and strong position, particularly because China has recently used its leverage over rare earth elements to bring the US to the table to cause a de-escalation of Trump's tariff war with China. So it seems that you have, on the one hand, this sort of concern and anxiety about these dysfunctional elements of the Chinese economy, but on the other hand, an exuberance and a sense that the decline of the United States relative to China is inevitable and is somehow encoded into the patterns of history. I just wonder how you think this will play out. What happens next?
I think it's unquestionably true that Beijing really believes that America is in terminal decline. I'm not saying that everybody thinks that way. And, you know, sometimes I read Chinese sort of international relations people and political opinion formers and so on that actually say it may be in relative decline, but it's certainly still an extremely powerful and capable country. Maybe not in the best care at the moment, but we would be foolish to dismiss it. But actually, I do think that there's an element in the official line, so to speak, from Beijing, which actually does hold that view, which that America is in kind of terminal decline, and therefore, you know, they just have to play their cards right and bide their time and everything will come their way. Yeah, I mean, I think that's their view. I don't think it's a correct view any more than I think the opposite view is right, which is that we think, you know, that China is inevitably going to rise and dominate the world forever to be. I mean, all of these extreme views, or these are just extrapolations from things that we see going on around us at the moment. And actually, there are, you know, very powerful sort of institutional and political influences and constraints, which I think we may still only be in the foothills of figuring out just how strong and powerful they are. So there's a kind of a little known, but he should be much better known, American economist who wrote in 1946, this chap called Albert Hirschman. He was very fascinated about countries that he called power traders. And he specifically had in mind Germany in the first half of the 20th century. Obviously, we don't have time to go into this in great detail, but you might get somebody to write about him. But Hirschman was very kind of perceptive about the coercion and power that countries that used trade and finance, very conscious about how countries could achieve incredible results and outcomes in their favor for a while, but how that the policies that would produce these outcomes would actually be much more destabilizing and even destructive if the country in question didn't pay attention to the kind of dysfunctional institutions that actually helped to bring them about. So I'm a big believer in the role that institutions play. So these are legal institutions, regulatory institutions, competition institutions, education institutions, even social institutions like, you know, labor unions and so on. I'm a big believer these institutions play a very, very important role in enabling countries to adapt, withstand shocks, overcome them, reinvent themselves. I mean, America's been reinventing itself for almost its entire existence. And I think you would be a bit kind of naive to say that the troubles that it's going through right now are terminal. I mean, it may well be that this is just a terrible period for the United States, but it's a period that it has to go through because the world is changing, it has to change, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, it's a kind of a different discussion, but the idea that we can kind of extrapolate almost like on a spreadsheet and say that, you know, the world is going to look like this in 10 or 20 or 30 years' time because it looks like this today, I think is just, I just don't think that really works. And I think the sort of battle of wits, if you want to put it this way, between fundamentally democratic and accountable institutions and top-down state institutions, I think is really a very important kind of battleground for the future.
I think that's quite a good note on which to end the conversation, actually. George Magnus, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you indeed.